So, good evening. Probably want to start by saying I realized after last week that I probably picked the most nebulous thing to talk about ever. And the strange part about it is, which is a good thing, is that in a retreat environment where the conditions are so well protected, it's all clear, makes so much sense. But the further I get away from the retreat, the more nebulous this gets and the more like hazy. So if you think about, if there's any sci-fi people in here, then you know going through the nebulous, it's very fuzzy and difficult to maneuver through. And I just remember all week thinking, oh my God, what topic have I picked? But the thing, because we're talking about distortions, and it's so nebulous because we don't know there's a distortion there. It's almost like there's the main reason this is so difficult is because the very thing we're trying to see, we can't see it. It's sleight of the hands with the mind. So all week I've been trying to figure out how in the world am I going to talk about this. I even negotiated coming in and saying, okay, I can't explain the distortions. I'm just not even going to try it. It's too nebulous now. But for you sci-fi buffs out there, you know that when that ship finally gets through the nebulous, it's all clear. It just clears up. And this morning I woke up with this clear, what I hope is going to be a clearer way to talk about this, to help us see what it is that what these distortions do, because I can begin to see how much the distortions are coming more realistic for me right now. I could see the distortions much more when I was in the retreat than I could see it right now. So there's got to be something that these distortions are doing for us as human beings that kind of support us. And so I don't want you to take this as some kind of one more bad thing about being human that I got to try to work on. Put that in the bucket list of things I got to work on so when I die, I have liberation. It's not like that. That is not what these distortions are. And I think the clarity that I'm hoping I can bring today, you're going to begin to see that the distortion is actually a gift. Milarepa, who was my favorite teacher, mainly because he came from so much violence and so much anger and still found enlightenment, and also because he's blunt. So he says, see demons as demons, that's the danger. Know they are powerless, that's the way. Understand them for what they are, that is deliverance. Recognize them as your father and mother, that is their end. Realize that they are creations of the mind, they become its glory. When these truths are known, everything is liberation. So it's a little, you have to take this and think about it a little bit. Because we all think demons are demons. We know what demons are. They're the bad things. And that very thought right there, seeing demons as demons, is how we start trudging into the danger. So I thought a way to explain the distortion we're going to talk about tonight is going to work better with examples. And of course, I have lots of them. But I narrowed it down so that it'll fit in 45 minutes. So let's start with one example, kind of like to frame how we'd frame these distortions. And for those of you who wear glasses, this is going to make sense. Because if you think of the distortion as glasses, then when I look through my glasses at things, especially I used to have a pair of glasses that didn't even have any rims to them, and they were so lightweight, you know, they were like bendable. I just couldn't keep them. One, because I never knew I had the glasses on. I couldn't, you know, I would go to sleep with them on and I'd wake up with them on. I just couldn't, you have to know that you have these glasses on. But that's sort of the problem with the distortion. When we look through glasses, we just see that which we're looking at. I just see you. I'm just looking at life and I just see life. I almost have to look at the rim to know that I'm looking through glasses. If I take the glasses off, I can't see, right? I can see fuzzy things, but I certainly will have to give up reading because that's not going to happen. So a distortion, in some respects, it's not so much that the distortion corrects. It's not that I'm trying to say like glasses are a corrective lens, then the distortion is correcting something. That's not what I'm really pointing to. What I'm pointing to is the distortion can have me thinking that I can see the fine print. And I can through the glasses, but I can't without it. If I forget that I'm looking at the world through glasses, then I get lost in the distortion. This ignorance that Tim was talking about in the Four Noble Truths, that cause of the ignorance that desire grows out of, it's like forgetting you have glasses on. It's like forgetting that you see the world not as your eyes show you, but through another lens. And the distortion is that lens we are looking through. Another way, so I wanted to make sure I don't forget, but that wisdom would be when you notice that there isn't a distortion there, that the distortion is coloring how you see things. So another way of looking at it is, I don't know anything about construction, so I don't want to give you the impression that I know anything about construction. But living on Capitol Hill, construction is everywhere. And I did not realize the depth of foundations when they build a lot of these buildings. I didn't realize how far down they dig out holes to build these foundations for these giant apartment buildings to be on. To those of you who know about construction, you may think, well, that's pretty clear. But all I would see is the building at street level. But there is a much deeper depth that the foundation that holds that building at street level is built on. When you walk around and you look at all these buildings, you don't necessarily see any of that depth. But there's something much deeper than just what you see at street level. Beginning to practice with these distortions is how we begin to see that deeper depth underground stuff that's going on within us. Not from a sense of, oh, there's something wrong with me, look at all this crap I got down there. It's not that. As much as it is beginning to see that which I think I'm looking at isn't necessarily reality. There is something else deeper behind all this. Here's something from Ajahn Sumedho. He says, of course we can always imagine perfect conditions, how it should be ideally, how everyone should behave. But it is not our task to create an ideal world. It's our task to see how it is and to learn from the world as it is. For the awakening heart, conditions are always good enough. When you begin to see that we could shift the way we think about suffering, it could change everything in how we relate to our entire world. But to do this, we have to shift our way of relating to what we think of as suffering to something different. And hopefully tonight we're going to begin to look at suffering from a different way. So we're going to start talking about the second distortion, which is pursuing satisfaction from that which is unsatisfactory. I read another translation that I think is a much more to-the-point translation. It says, seeking pleasure from suffering. Sort of like we're looking, seeking some kind of positive experience from something that's only going to bring us suffering. We keep seeking this positive experience and we are only going to get a negative experience out of it. Or another way to think of it is, if the Buddha were to come walking in the door of our little Sangha here, and of course we'd all be like, ooh, the Buddha, the Buddha, the Buddha. And we could ask him, you know, tell us some wisdom. Tell us something that could keep us together from now on. And if he said that you are going to suffer every single day for the rest of your natural days, how would you take that? I mean, think about it. I know, as I even when I thought of this, I thought, oh, talk about bummer. I mean, just the very thought of that sounds like it's going to be miserable. If you're 20, God! If you're in your 60s, you know, it's okay that you heard it at the end of your life. But that right there is an unawakened mind's way of looking at suffering. Because an unawakened mind thinks suffering is a bad thing, and that the only thing that we sort of need is good stuff. Awakened mind doesn't think like that. In an unawakened mind, the distortions are, it is the nature of the way all things are. It's the magic trick that the mind does. So the reason why Buddha would tell us that we have to suffer for the rest of our entire lives, every day, is because inherent to being alive is this pursuit of something joyous, this pursuit of some happiness. But at the same time, there is nothing reliable about anything that we're going to choose to pursue this happiness. It's not just us. If you think about it, all living beings pursue happiness. All living beings, they pursue pleasures. Flowers, as soon as the sun comes up, they're wide awake and they follow the sun wherever the sun goes, because there is this constant pursuit of pleasure and happiness. That's why if the Buddha were to tell us that we would have to experience suffering for the rest of our lives, every single day, to the unawakened mind, that is a problem. That means that we have to immediately rethink. That means unpleasant. Unpleasant for the rest of my life. It's just going to be miserable. But to the awakened mind, you could hear that as quite a gift. If you knew that when you felt suffering, that was the key to bring the cessation of suffering, then suffering wouldn't be a problem. If you knew that every time you actually realized you were suffering, that you were just inches, moments, just a sliver away from the cessation of that suffering, then you would be happy to know that suffering existed, because you would know the escape out of it. And I think that is the nature of the Four Noble Truths, that sort of understanding that you guys spent the entire month thinking about. That is the nature of those Four Noble Truths. All that Buddha was basically saying was, you have to recognize that suffering exists. I think I probably realized more about these distortions when I first began to realize suffering exists. Because no matter how much we grumble about how we think our life is full of suffering, we rarely notice it. We react to it a lot. But we rarely notice that that's what we're doing. So this idea of noticing that there is suffering is the key to then begin to turn and look at what is driving that suffering. But before we get to that, I'm going to talk about that closer to the end. I think what I want to start with is getting to an understanding of what, how to look at what the mind does, or these distortions on each level around this pursuing pleasure. What happens when we're pursuing pleasure? And given that I did a lot of pleasure pursuing in February, I have plenty of examples to show you. So last week I said there's three layers to this pursuing these distortions. They show up in our thoughts, they show up in our perceptions, they show up in our views. So the thought level is what I would call our problem-solving mode. We think there's a problem, and we get in the mode to try to fix that problem. Let me see where my... Matthew Ricard said, we want the world to allow the unconditional fulfillment of our aspirations. And since this does not happen, we fall prey to suffering. Our search for happiness is more often founded on our illusions than on reality. It is pointless to try to shape the world to fit our desires. We must transform our minds. So, I shared last week that I started my two-month retreat trying to have these good sits. I wanted to have these great sits of deep concentration. So the first couple of weeks, I had a rocky road because my digestive system could not really get with Cloud Mountain's food. It was either too spicy. So then I went to what they call the simple foods table, which just steamed vegetables, and it created way too much gas. So I'm going from constipation, gas, but that's okay. Because this retreat, I brought with me antacids, and I brought laxatives, and I was ready for whatever came up. Ibuprofen for any pain, I was ready. So if pain came, I took ibuprofen. Gas came, took antacids. Constipation came, took laxatives. No problem. I just solved the problem. Whatever problem existed, I solved it. Now, all that emotional stuff that was going on, I was going to get to that after I got peaceful and concentrated. Then I could really look at it. But I had to brush it aside so I could get to a good sit. And so I spent the first 2 weeks going back and forth, taking all these pills, constantly feeling just achy because I couldn't get my digestive system on track. I'm trying to solve the problem. One other problem was happening. I was not getting enough to eat. So every meal, I would fill up on all this food. So I'm stuffed. And then I would go and I'd sit. And I would sit, I sit pretty long times at retreats, you know, a long time. And by the time I would get to the end of the sit, I would feel hungry. And I thought, oh, well, that makes sense. I just sat a long time. I didn't do anything but just sat there. But, you know, it's a lot of energy with sitting. I could see why I'm hungry. And I would get through it my sit, and I would go get something to eat. And I was eating and eating and eating. Gas upon gas, constipation. You see where I'm going, right? It never dawned on me that I was creating all these problems. It never dawned on me one time. All I kept doing was solving the problem that was at hand. And then after about 2 weeks into this, I remember coming close to the end of a sit, and like clockwork, I started getting hungry. Hunger pains. And I remember thinking, how could I be so hungry all the time? I didn't understand. I never eat like this at home. And then it hit me. It's like I begin to recognize, aha, there's suffering here. Something's wrong. What is this that's happening here? And then I begin to look at what exactly I'm doing with this food. So the food helped me not have to deal with all this emotional stuff. Instead, I was solving problems between gas and eating and all of that. I didn't have to deal with emotional problems. But the fact that I noticed the suffering, finally noticed the first noble truth, I noticed that there was suffering. Then I begin to look at the cause. I begin to look at how I was trying to sort of eat my way away from difficulty. The more I could begin to eat my way through difficulty, the more I noticed that, this desire to be full. I think it's sort of like this desire to be full, to be wrapped in this blanket, to be taken care of. And when you don't have a lot of food or you're hungry, there's this sense of I'm not being taken care of. So here I am trying to get taken care of, and I am creating havoc instead. But when I stepped into that first noble truth, and I stepped into this reality that I'm suffering here, this is not working, then I did some shifting. I started eating less, much less. and drinking water. As you know, half the time I thought I was hungry, I really was just thirsty. So drinking water, doing some things that were different, right? Actually dealing with what it is that I was ignoring, and begin to actually watch what I was eating. So when the sit would happen, I still had the hunger pains for a while, probably a few more days of sits. There was this sense of inevitably, like clockwork, I'd get these hunger pains. But then I would just sort of tell myself, that is a distortion to where you're not hungry. You're fine. Plenty of food, don't worry. And then I could settle back and wait for that to pass. It's the gift of impermanence that we talked about as a distortion, but the impermanence is also the gift because you begin to see that things pass. But you first have to see that you're pursuing something to keep you from suffering. And the thoughts is when we get trapped in this kind of not paying attention, mindlessly going about solving problems without really recognizing that maybe what we think of as a problem is our avoidance of suffering. And if we could see that we're suffering, then maybe that what we call a problem wouldn't exist. I have another. This is from Jack Kornfield. We continue to create suffering, waging war with good, waging war with evil, waging war with what's too small, waging war with what's too big, waging war with what's too short, too long, right, wrong, courageously carrying on this battle. That's sort of what I was doing. Courageously solving all my health problems, feeding myself enough, rather than stepping into the suffering that was actually going on. That's the first one. If I think about it, my suffering with my digestion was like the key to help me find my way through this. Basically, it was the key to help me come into presence with a lot of emotional stuff. But there's a second way that the distortion shows up. And this layer is more on our perception. I call it my just this once mode, right? Because it affects our habitual way of being with things. It's not a habit for me to sort of have diarrhea or constipation or gas or any of that. That's sort of not a habit. I just sort of was dealing with that at the retreat. But what is a habit for me is sweets. Oh, I love sweets. And so before I went on the retreat, I decided that I would get the little tiny snack bags just so I can be prepared and protected from myself. Put just a couple of pieces of licorice in there and a couple of pieces of sweet in each little bag, and I counted them all out so I'd have one bag a day for the retreat, because they do not give you much sweets at the retreats. So I went prepared, and I had it all divided out. Everything was going to be okay. Yeah, no. I would get a bag, like I'm supposed to. A couple hours later, I would get another bag. But I wouldn't think, oh, I'm getting another bag. I would just think, oh, I'll just get this one bag. It's okay. I have plenty. I mean, I had tons of bags. I had 60 bags, right? So just take this one bag. Not going to be a problem. You guys already know where I'm going, don't you? man, I almost ate all those bags in 2 weeks. I just kept taking a bag, and I couldn't really see. I couldn't see that I was taking yet another bag, yet another bag, yet another bag. I couldn't see it, because when you eat candy, and you're a person who's like addicted to candy or something, that sweet is covering all the sadness. It's covering all the fear. It's covering all the difficulty. It's making everything great. I'm all happy. Everything's going good. Oh, don't worry about the digestion. Don't worry about all the sweet. It's going to be good. It's going to be good. Everything's going to be fine. But you see what's happening? I keep taking this bag of sweets thinking that it's going to make everything better. I'm going to feel more cheery, more happy. And I'm not paying attention to how many bags I'm eating in a day. I can't see it. We can't see these distortions. You have to wait until something uncomfortable happens sometimes. And of course, what happens when you eat too much sugar? Toothaches. So I get this serious toothache. And that is sort of what helped me realize I am eating way too much sugar, way too much candy. This isn't working like this. So I took all the candy. I will never do this again with candy, but I took all the candy and I gave it to the office and said, give it back to me when the retreat's over. And they graciously took it, and they graciously gave it back to me when the retreat was over. And of course, by the time I got home, I finished the rest of it off. But the point that I'm making is that our habitual way of responding to things, the way that that distortion is our gift, is it starts to tap at us and tell us something's wrong. We start feeling the rub of that distortion. And when we start feeling the rub of that distortion, that is not the time to double down on the distortion. Double down on our seeking pleasure. That is the key to unlock the door to get out of this. I did not need that candy. I gave it back and I was fine. I thought about it. I mean, every time I'd go in the room, I'd look at the place where I had it, you know. I just had this kind of constant dwelling on it. But then impermanence arose and it passed on. Here's something from Gil Fronsdal. People who don't see their choices do not believe they have choices. They tend to respond automatically, blindly, influenced by their circumstances and conditioning. Mindfulness, by helping us notice our impulses before we act, gives us the opportunity to decide whether to act and how to act. It's this mindfulness paying attention to the suffering that's around us. We have to look for it because the mind is not trained to let you know you're suffering. It seems kind of strange because we could all sit here and run down a list of problems. But if you think you're in sadness, you don't know you're suffering. You know you're sad. But you can't see the suffering yet. It's when we step outside of that so-called sadness and just feel something, feel the pain of it, the uncomfortableness of it, the rub of it, the I don't like this of it. When we can feel that, then we're not caught in the concept of what's going on, and we can actually begin to look at it from a different perspective. So I want to give you a different way of looking at this. It doesn't have to always be bad. Suffering isn't always some negative thing. It could also be a positive thing. So once I started working with these distortions, I started looking for them everywhere. And I like dining halls. I love restaurants. I get so excited. I like the, I shouldn't say this, but there's a game that one of my nieces have where it's like a restaurant and you get so many points and you do the restaurant thing. I'm not quite sure how the game works. I don't really do video games. But I love to listen to her play it because there's all these dishes clanging and things that happen in restaurants and you can tell when she's making a lot of money or getting a lot of points because there's all the dishes clanging. There's something about restaurants, the moving, the dishes, the talking, I love it. So I would sit in the dining hall and just be so excited and so happy, feel great in the dining hall listening to like just dishes and people eating, no talking, but you know, just the hum of it. And then one day I said, why do I like this so much? You know, what is this that I'm so attached to this dining hall? It's just sound. How come this sound is so much more attractive to me than other sounds? I'm sitting there, and then it comes to me. You know, I grew up in a very big family. There's like 10 of us. So we didn't do the restaurant thing. And I didn't even go to a restaurant and sit down and eat till I was in high school, and we used to go to Denny's because you could order coffee and then that's it. You could sit there all night, drink coffee and talk. So all of my friends, we would meet at Denny's down there in Airport Way down there by Boeing Field, and we would sit and drink coffee hours. I could see why Denny's had to change that policy. All these kids would come in at night after 2 and then just sit there and drink coffee. And it was the never-ending pot of coffee. So really, you just pay for a pot of coffee and then that's it. Maybe some fries or something. But I sat there and realized that that is what I think is happening in restaurants. It's not that I'm present to the restaurant today or the dining hall now. I realized that emotionally, I'm still back in high school, sitting here experiencing what I had then. Not necessarily now. It's this distorted perception of what's happening now, when in reality, I'm sitting there, no one's looking at you. I'm not with a group of friends, we're all talking and having a good time. I'm just sitting there listening to dishes. And this reality came to me that I am applying Memorex, a tape recording of my life in a restaurant to this current moment. So just imagine, just extrapolate what that means. I begin to wonder how much of my life I actually live, or how much of it is just Memorex. I'm just reliving all these habitual patterns and places and things. Things that I don't like, I just don't like them. I think I don't like it because I'm clear, this, I don't like this. But who knows where that I don't like it comes from? Who knows where that I like this, this is great, this is fun, this is good. Who knows where that comes from? If you don't take the moment to sit and think about your likes, your dislikes, where does it come from? Then you get trapped in them. It's the tanha that Tim was talking about, that thirst for something, to become something, that thirst to not have something, or seeking out all these sensual pleasures as if somehow or another that is reality. But those are all trapped in these distortions. So there's one more mode, which is the, I couldn't think of a catchy phrase, so it's just thinking objects are causing suffering mode. It's the last level, it's our sort of human view. That's what Andrea Fella calls it. It's the idea that whenever we have any suffering, it is the thing or the situation we are involved in that's causing that suffering. You can see why you have the fix-it mode, the problem-solving mode, because the mind starts thinking, oh, I just need to fix this, solve it. I need to change this one thing and then I will be happy. Or you can see the just this once mode in that because we begin to think, oh, this is the problem. If I just get a little candy, then I'll perk right up and everything will be fine. You can begin to see this thinking that the cause of our problems is something outside of us. That's the problem. That's the distortion. That's the big main distortion. An example I want to show you how that shows up is the first month, Spirit Rock has ticks, if those of you who haven't been there, and they have all these signs all over the place saying, beware of the ticks, because they carry Lyme disease, and there's all this precaution, and it's just talking, so I am big scaredy cat. I'm not going nowhere, there's grass. The only place I would walk is down the main path, big wide street, and up the main path. I don't go in any grass nowhere, all of February. And I begin to realize that the limiting nature of that, right? The limiting nature, because people were going on hikes and I could see them up along the ridge and these beautiful hiking trails, but I'm limited to just the main road down to the dining hall, main road back up to the meditation hall. That's it. We're not going anywhere else. And I begin to realize this is so limiting, this fear. I'm scared of snakes, but the fear, this fear is what begin to eat at me. Like this, begin to see that the fear limited all of my possibilities. So I'm gonna walk on some of these hiking trails. I put big socks on, all the way up to here. Stuffed my pants down into the socks. I have hiking boots, light color clothes, sprayed all the stuff. I'm totally protected. And I watched how the mind continuously talked about this. So I want to give you an example. I busted out and started laughing because I'm walking down the trail and my hair hit this branch. And I thought it was a boa constrictor. It's about to wrap around me and tighten up and that's it, it's all over. See how you're laughing now? That's what I did. I hurt myself. I heard this image in my head of this gigantic snake wrapping around. It's not even true. But in the body, I felt as if it was true. I could see that I could feel it as if it were true, but it was not true. It's beginning to look at suffering as a way to see things like this, to see the humor and the joyousness and the joking about how totally ridiculous these distortions are. They're over the top ridiculous. But because we don't see them, We don't know that all of our fears in this room are unfounded. I mean, there might be some fears out there that are justifiably afraid. But that's because in that moment, something dangerous is happening. But mostly, we live in the fear that something dangerous is going to happen, and it never does. It never has happened. I know so many people who tell me, I can't go out at certain times or certain places. I said, have you ever been attacked? No. But I know I could be attacked. Do you know anybody that's gotten attacked there? No. But I know somebody could get attacked. You see how these fears go? But you can feel it in the body as if it's real. And the only way to know it's not real is to begin to see that you have glasses on and there's a distortion there. So of course, by the end of the second month, I was hiking all along the ridge. It's so beautiful. Anybody that goes to Spirit Rock, I would suggest that you go hiking. The 14th Dalai Lama said that it seems that often when problems arise, our outlook becomes narrow. It is that narrowing that the distorted mind does that keeps us from seeing all the stuff underground and seeing that we're actually looking out of framed glasses. We're not really seeing things as they really are. So, last thing I want to talk about is, how do we practice with these distortions? You know, assuming you want to work with them, how are you going to practice with them? Especially if you can't see them, right? You start with this looking at suffering a different way. That's probably the biggest barrier to our working with these distortions. Is we have a tendency to think that suffering inherently means bad. And if we flip that and begin to see suffering as a gift, it doesn't say anything about you. It just says something about the moment that you are pushing up against something in this moment. So that first capacity to be able to say, there's suffering here. I see it. You almost have to pat yourself on the back. I see it! Because we don't see it. That first thing is seeing it. There's a famous quote by Ajahn Chah that says there are two kinds of suffering. The suffering that leads to more suffering and the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. If you are not willing to face the second kind of suffering, you will surely continue to experience the first. That's what we begin to realize. In our attempts to avoid suffering, we continuously create more and more and more suffering. So working with these distortions, because the distortions in and of themselves, to me, are so humorous when you begin to see them. They're so over the top crazy that you can use that idea as beginning to let suffering arise in your life and see it as a doorway, as a key. Don't run from it. Don't run from that suffering and don't get swallowed up by it. If you're irritated, don't try to quickly dismiss that irritation and say, buck up, I'm a meditator. We shouldn't be irritated. We should be happy with everything. No, let yourself be irritated and feel that for a while. Sit with that tension so that you can see that there may be some desire, that tanha, that Tim was talking about, you could feel the desire of not wanting something the way it is. Or you want something to be a certain way. You can feel that. And then, if you just stay with that, you can begin to see some distortion. Like you're trying to make something satisfy you that's not going to satisfy you ever. You're trying to hold on to something as permanent, and it's not permanent. It never was permanent. You could begin to see it. And when you see it, it's so noticeably irrational that the idea of letting go is just, why would I pick that up? Why would I be afraid of a boa constrictor? Right? You just, the minute you see it, you know it's crazy. If I see what I'm eating with candy and feel this toothache, why would I keep eating it? Taking it down and getting rid of it was not a problem. It would have been a major problem if someone had said, okay, all you guys that brought candy, let's take it down and get rid of it. I would have had a major problem. I actually gave up my cell phone. The idea of not playing solitaire was just over the top for me. But it's things like that. You can do that when you begin to see these distortions. Letting it go is not some force of will. I want to read this last, this is a thing from Ajahn Chah. He's talking about something that the Buddha, he's talking about a story about the Buddha. It said, Buddha once saw a jackal, a wild dog, running out of the forest where he was staying. It stood still for a while, and then it ran into the underbrush, and then it ran out again. Then it ran into a tree, hollow. Then it ran out again. Then it went into a cave, only to run back out again. One minute it stood, the next it ran. Then it laid down, then it jumped up. The jackal had mange. When it stood, the mange would eat into its skin, so it would run. Running, it was still uncomfortable, so it would stop. Standing, it was still uncomfortable, so it would run into the underbrush, the tree hollow. It would never stay still. The Buddha said, monks, did you see that jackal this afternoon? Standing, it suffered. Running, it suffered. Sitting, it suffered. Lying down, it suffered. It blamed standing for its discomfort. It blamed sitting. It blamed running and lying down. It blamed the tree, the underbrush, and the cave. In fact, the problem was with none of those things. The problem was with the mange. We are just the same as that jackal. Our discontent is due to wrong view. Because we don't exercise the sense restraints, we blame our suffering on our externals. This is Ajahn Chah. Whether we live in Thailand, America, or England, we aren't satisfied. Why not? Because we still have wrong view. Just that. So wherever we go, we aren't content. But just as the jackal would be content wherever it went, as soon as the mange was cured, so would we be content wherever we went once we rid ourselves of wrong view. I think I'll leave it there. I like the silence after a talk. Not directed silence, just the silence that arises on its own. So if you have any questions, I probably can take a few before I answer some, talk about some announcements. So the question was if I could talk some about going into the suffering and not being swallowed by the suffering. And going into the suffering, when I say that, it's sort of like an embodied process. So you are, it's like when we sit and meditate. You are sitting and we are meditating. We are sitting here. We're not doing anything. So let's say that I'll just use my standard fare, something I got mad at, right? I get mad at something, and if I think about what I'm mad about, I get swallowed up into it. But holding suffering means you let go of any concept about what this is and just sit there and notice maybe some thoughts are there, but your main energy is in the body. So those four foundations of mindfulness, that's what those four foundations of mindfulness do to help us. If you put your attention on the sensation in the body and let go of all the thinking process, or if you put your sensation on, say, the feeling tone of it, like this, the feeling of being unpleasant, or the feeling of being pleasant, or if you put your attention on, I like the third noble truth, I like to think of them as moods, right? So really the Buddha gave four ordinary mind, four great minds, but you could think of it as lust or that wanting, anger or that aversion, a distracted mind or a constricted mind. And so I just look and see, is the mind caught in some kind of lust? Because I like the word lust because it has an edge of gotta have it. And I like anger, which helps me see that there's kind of like a shoving back. So is the mind angry? Is the mind caught in lust? Is the mind distracted in something else or constricted? If you begin to look into like those states of mind or what kind of mood you're in. I think that is better for the third truth than emotions. You're working with emotions, but sometimes if we think, oh, I feel sad, then conceptually we get caught up in what makes us sad. And we're not trying to look at what makes us sad. We're trying to experience all of this sensation. Maybe there's some thoughts going, but who said that sadness? Where does that come from, this idea that it's sadness? And if you let yourself hold this, not from a place of, this is me, Tuere, who's sad, but just from the sensations of what's happening, and the thing that is the most helpful is being aware that things come and go. There is the arising and passing. So you let whatever sensations rise and pass away, whatever second Vedana, whether there's a feeling tone is pleasant or unpleasant, you just let these things rise and fall and rise and fall. You don't have to try to figure out what the tanha is or what the distortion is. It'll come to you. You will begin to just kind of sense into, oh, I don't like this. I'm trying to get rid of something. And you can begin to just Don't stop there. Stay there with, I don't like this, I don't want this, I don't want this to happen. You can sense into that sense of realizing, I don't want this, or I wish I could get this, I wish I could, I need this, or this leaning into it. If you just stay there, then you could maybe ask the little question, like, what's the distortion here? Are you trying to hold on to something, make it permanent when really it's time to pass? Are you trying to use something to satisfy your, you know, disillusion or your boredom or whatever to keep from having to feel some unpleasantness when in reality that's not going to satisfy you? You can begin to see. I think we don't really talk about it very much, but from my perspective, little thoughts, as there is the noting, like, oh, planning mind or whatever, but I think there should be more directed thought, like asking yourself from time to time, is there suffering here? Am I suffering? If you find yourself caught in something, you have to ask yourself, am I suffering? Am I aware of what's going on? Because the mind will cloud over this idea of suffering, and we won't know that we are. So you almost have to ask yourself, is there suffering here? So that you can begin to feel the uncomfortableness of it. That's the suffering, not the fact that you're mad. Because that's what we think is suffering. And we think, oh, if I just don't, if I get over the anger, then I'm cool. But the suffering is the pain that's being, that you're making in this situation with yourself, and has nothing to do with whatever the situation is or the object. So does that help? So it's really just trying to let go of any concept of what's happening to you and see if you could hold this without judgment, without some kind of, oh, something's wrong, something's bad happening, and just be with it for a few minutes and see what happens. It doesn't really take the heart. When you've been practicing, it doesn't take the heart long to tell you what's going on. It's just having the willingness to stop and not just judge everything as if we know what's going on. To stop, feel the uncomfortableness of this, and give the heart time to tell us where we are trapped. That's what that distortion is. That's what that suffering is. It is a rub. It's telling us our wanting or our not wanting is in direct conflict with reality. Okay? Anybody else? Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do we resolve that with the meta of asking to be free from suffering, wishing to be free from suffering?
Think of meta as a, it's, okay, let me think of it like this. In order for us to hold suffering, because the mind doesn't want to hold suffering, it's a bad thing. In order for us to hold it, there is this need to open the heart. Metta, and then its counterpart to suffering, which is compassion, is what holds this. If you try to just hold your suffering in your mind is going to basically tell you, you're sad. This is wrong. They shouldn't have done that. It's pretty clear why we have to do all this. Because the mind thinks suffering is a bad thing. It's looking for pleasure. Because pleasure, good, unpleasant, bad. Metta is what opens the heart. And we can't look at this suffering without having an open heart. It's the heart that holds this. So we do this metta kind of like this. You don't make yourself be free of suffering, but you're asking into the kind of the universe, the space, for this opening to be free from suffering. But ultimately, that liberation is going to come from being able to sit there with suffering without the judgment that it's bad. That comes from our metta, our Brahmavihara practices. That's where you get the capacity to look at these things. Right? Long enough for you to see the third noble truth and see the cessation of it. Okay? All right, good.